So, good morning. Welcome to Narcisse. What's our date? February 4th, 2017. And we're going to be looking at, I just wrote up references on the board. These are our triennial parasha references. Have you guys been here since we've been doing triennial parasha?
Sure.
Back there? Okay, so what we've been doing for the last year is reading through the first five books of the Bible, but instead of going by the pace that everybody uses in all Jewish communities today, well, not all, most, the dominant, they finish it in a year. We have been doing the schedule of reading that goes at a much slower pace that takes about 3 years to finish. This seems to be historically, or some such reading pattern, was what Jesus would have used with his disciples. And so we thought it would be of interest to follow in Jesus' footsteps and slow down the pace, because what ends up happening is you get different focus. When you have a smaller chunk to work through, it ends up getting linked up in a different way to the haftarah. So if your parasha is your main meal, haftarah is dessert. So your main meal is Torah from the first five books. Your dessert is from the prophets. And we have noticed a preponderance of Isaiah. It seems every week it's Isaiah, a different portion. And that's nice. Also in the New Testament, we have a preponderance of Isaiah quotes. What can you say? Isaiah was a great, great prophet. And not just that, a great artist. He was a poet. He was very well trained to deliver prophecy in a very poetic way, which packs a punch stronger than newspaper talk.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
So you're saying the three-year pattern seems to be maybe what Jesus called more?
Right.
Not just a general rhetorical question, right?
Right. The three-year pattern seems to be what was in practice in Jesus' day.
In the land here.
Here in the land of Israel.
Outside, towards like Babylon, can be more of the annual.
Even in Jesus' day?
That's what I was reading.
That's what Perot said?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So these are the portions, and a lot of this stuff has been found. These links, these connections have been found in Cairo, Geniza, and other places, and people have done a lot of work putting them together, publishing them, so we're basing it off of their work. But you can definitely see how they link up together when you start reading. And so that's what we're going to do first together, is just read through these passages and hear them and hear the connection that there might be between this the parasha and the haftarah. And of course, we can also talk about what they each individually mean as well, as that pertains. Okay, so let's start. Gemma, are you ready to start us off?
Sure.
In Exodus 22, 24, if everyone can just read three or four verses, we should get through it.
My anger will be aroused. Do you not want to start in 22?
20, yeah, did I say 23? 22.
You
20,
said
it. Chapter 22, verse 24.
Yeah, that's what you said, but I'm going to start in verse 22, because otherwise it's halfway through a sentence, I think. Do not take advantage of the widow or the fatherless. If you do and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry. That's where we ended last week. My anger will be aroused, and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives will become widows and your children fatherless. If you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, do not treat it like a business deal. Charge no interest. If you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, return it by sunset, because that cloak is the only covering your neighbor has. What else can they sleep in? When they cry out to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. Do not blaspheme God or curse the ruler of your people. Do not hold back offerings from your granaries or your vats.
The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and your sheep. 7 days it shall be with its mother, and on the eighth day you shall give it to me. You shall be consecrated to me. Therefore you shall not eat any flesh that is torn by beasts in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs.
You shall not raise a false report. Put not your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shall you testify in a dispute to follow after a crowd to prevent judgment. Neither shall you be partial to a poor man in his cause. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him.
If you see the donkey of someone who hates you falling down under its load, do not leave it there. Be sure to help them with it. Do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuits. Have nothing to do with a false charge. Do not put an innocent or honest person to death, for I will not acquit the guilty. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe warns those who see and twist the words of the righteous. Do not oppress an alien. You yourselves know how it feels to be aliens, because you are aliens in Egypt.
For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather its yield. But the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may have rest, and the son of your servant woman and the alien may be refreshed.
And in all things that I have said unto you, be circumspect and make no mention of the name of other gods, neither let it be heard out of your mouth. 3 times thou shalt keep a feast unto me in the year, thou shalt keep the feast of unleavened bread, thou shalt eat unleavened bread 7 days of the managing time appointed of the month of Aviv, for in it thou camest out from Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty, and the feast of harvest, the first fruits of the labors which thou hast sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering, which is in the end of the year, when thou hast gathered in thy labors out of the field.
3 times a year all the mankind shall appear before the sovereign Lord. Do not offer the blood of the sacrifice to me along with anything containing yeast. The fat of my festival offerings must not be kept until morning. Bring the best of the first fruits of your soil to the house of the Lord your God. Do not cook a young goat in its mother's milk.
All right. I like that ending there. Before we read the prophetic section, what is your impression of these laws? What are they about?
About the holidays.
There's some about holidays.
Some about social justice.
Some about social justice, yeah.
I like the ones about animals. I love if you come across your enemy's ox wandering off, be sure to return it. Yeah. I'm sure then it happened, but the idea now of just finding an ox wandering around.
Well, obviously you'd have to find the equivalent.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking of the equivalent. I was just thinking it's got a nice tinge of...
your enemy's ox.
Would this be the laws that like the Good Samaritan would have followed?
It could be.
The Samaritans, this is part of their Bible. So.
Yeah. Gary's pointing out the Samaritans, it's part of the Samaritan. Samaritans follow the Torah and nothing else. So they wouldn't have this connection in Isaiah, but they would have this law.
So this means if you see your enemy with a flat tire, you have to help him change it.
If you see your enemy with a flat tire, get out and change a tire. That's exactly what it means.
That's
nice part. These are some serious laws. Okay, so last week you did with Gary Mishpatim. It's basically, this section of laws in the Bible is called the Book of the Covenant. And if you want kind of an overview of laws in the Bible. There's a nice book you can read by Menachem Sauna called Exploring Exodus.
Nahum.
Oh, sorry. Nahum Sauna. Exploring Exodus. And he does a pretty good job of laying out what we know about laws in Mesopotamia, in the ancient Near East. And it really helps, I think, give a context for some of these laws that, as Gemma pointed out, we don't have much context for today in our Western society. We don't see oxes wandering around. And last week you discussed a goring ox. This is not one of our problems today. You know, we don't get all hot and heated over goring oxes.
But you might over a speeding car.
You might over a speeding car, yes, for sure. You might over drunk drivers. These are more of our issues today. And so, of course, welcome.
Hey, welcome home.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
This booth is for you over here.
Okay, I'm all the way over here.
So, last week, the first section of this Book of the Covenant dealt with laws that were more in the state realm, court of laws. But this part is a little different. They're dvarim. They're more left up to our conscience to enforce. They're more for the individual to remember. And like has been mentioned here, there's a lot of concern for unfortunate people in society, especially for the poor people.
So this is kind of like where Jesus says, love your enemies, right?
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people...
But which enemies is he talking about? Is he talking about the Amalekites, or is he talking about a fellow...
Well, when it's, that's exactly what his disciples asked. Who is my friend? Who is my neighbor? It's that question, you know?
No, but he's not saying love your neighbor. It's saying love your enemy.
You're right.
Right?
He's saying love your enemy.
But we know who the neighbor is. Who's the enemy? Is
well, your neighbor might be your enemy.
Because the Amalekites, for example, you were supposed to go kill those people. You weren't supposed to help them.
Okay, so since the Amalekites are an exception, let's leave them to the side. Everybody else, there are plenty of other people who could qualify as enemies, right? You have Philistines, you have Moabites, you have Edomites.
Right. Yeah, but the Philistines, were you supposed to...
But the issue was actually, wasn't it, to do with the enemy were those who were basically fighting against... It's a spiritual issue.
Well,
because
yes and no, but it's also
gods.
A very real issue.
It's a real issue, but it doesn't say you've got to go and sort of to love those who are worshipping another god. It talks about David goes out and kills his enemies, but the battle, the way to understand the battle, as I see it, is a spiritual battle.
Well, here, I think it's important to separate state and individual. Here, they're laws to the individual.
Right.
So whether or not the state has the right to go out and make war against an enemy state, that's something
Absolutely.
Else. But when you meet that enemy on the road and you see his ox, you better help him because he's a human. And that's the amazing thing. If you compare these laws to, I mean, you've all heard of Hammurabi's laws, right?
Yeah.
They're the most famous, but there are many other laws. You can see a distinct difference as relates to the value of human life if you look at the biblical laws and their laws. And you can see it in many little ways. And again, I would recommend Sarna's book to do some of that footwork for you. But there's an elevation. Even slaves, even poor people that maybe... in society in the ancient Near East were considered to be of lesser value. They are not. They are still humans. They're still made in the image of God.
Well, here it says they get to keep Shabbat. The rabbis today
right.
say they can't.
So here we have an enemy. So someone that you do not like, you might hate, and yet they're humans, and because they're human, you have to treat them like that.
Is this restricted to a certain place, just this land?
These laws? Why?
Because it's well, for one thing, it's within Israel, so there it's. I'm just asking: are these laws just to do with how Israel or the Israelites are to deal with each other?
But this
and there are then alien is someone who is in the land.
Right, right.
But they're in Sinai now.
Well, for sure, laws are given to a particular context, right? So the people of Israel are in this land. And this is the law they've received in their time in history.
This is in Sinai. This is not in Israel yet.
Okay, but the laws reflected are reflecting the land that God is giving them. It repeatedly states that. When you get the first fruits, is that the first fruits in the desert?
Yeah,
it's the first fruits
in
Israel.
Are you supposed to keep Shabbat in Sinai, or you wait till you get to Israel to keep Shabbat?
Well, we had already the first story of the Shabbat was during the manna, where God gave that commandment first, before he gave the rest of the Torah.
So get used to this one.
So
they're keeping these commandments, and they're not in Israel yet?
Yes. Unless, yeah.
There are also some things when he says, when you enter the land.
Yeah, there are some that come into effect, especially if you're reading according to Deuteronomy. He has a much more of a future look, you could say, when you enter the land.
Putting the wall around the new growth, for instance, that's probably not a tent in the desert.
Yeah.
But is that a biblical command?
Yeah, it is. If you don't put a wall around your roof and someone falls and dies, it's...
Oh, I beg your pardon. I didn't hear the
you're
word.
You're liable for murder.
Yeah. No, I didn't hear what you said. I thought you were talking about a roof.
Yeah, but nobody walks on the roof of a tent. You fall in.
No, a roof.
And in Europe, no one walks on a roof either because they're made like this. But here in this land, they're flat and people go up on them.
And you get the evening breeze.
What do you do if you have to have a wall?
Well, this highlights the issue that these laws are given in a particular place and time to a particular historical context, and it does make a difference.
But people do go on sloped roofs.
Okay, so you take the principle of the laws and you have to reapply them in your situation. The same principles apply. If you have the same context, the same law would apply. If you don't have the same context, you have to take from the law and reapply it to your context.
My daughter-in-law says these laws don't apply to Gentiles.
Okay, you're right. I mean, they were originally given to the people of Israel.
She's right.
She's right in that they were originally given to the people of Israel. Right. They're part of the covenant.
I was asking.
However, then it's a question. This is a question in Acts 15. What do you do with people who are now grafted into this salvation story? So there's been this salvation story going on with the people of Israel this whole time. Jesus comes along. It's opened up to more than just Israel now. Now, what are these new believers? Or do they have to become Jews to be part of the story? And everybody got together and talked about it, and they came to a conclusion that no. God's already filled them with the Spirit. He's already given this mark of approval as they are. So the people who are Jews, they stay Jewish and believe in Jesus. The people who are Gentile believe in Jesus. They do not need to become Jews. And therefore, they need to follow this, and this. And you have a couple laws they need to follow. Now, does that mean that's all you need to do? Now you're allowed to lie and cheat and all of that? Of course not, because the idea is then you're educated from that point on. You're reading the text. You're understanding them. But you are called as you are. You're a Gentile.
But Jesus also says that he comes to fulfill the law, not to destroy the law.
Right.
And one of the teachings or one of the habits of the daughter-in-law type feeling ends up saying, well, the whole of the Old Testament is old. It was for the Jews. It's nothing to do with us anymore. We've got Jesus. We're not under the law. So hallelujah.
She might be coming from a different perspective. But
I don't know if that's where she's coming
that's
from.
Actually, she's Orthodox. She's Orthodox. So she is keeping all those things. But
she's an Orthodox Jew.
Yeah.
Right.
But
for instance,
I'm asking it from my perspective as a Christian.
Right.
And Sharon is coming pretty close to it. I mean, she's seeing what it is, but that brings up another question. You know,
where is she living?
Right?
Where is she living?
Jerusalem.
Oh, she's living here. Oh, good to say. Because she better keep the law about coming back to the land if she's that Orthodox.
I mean, and you could also say there's obviously, according to Deuteronomy, there's one law for the alien and for the resident. So they're trying to set up a system that's fair for everybody living in this land. And I think that principle carries over today as well. However, we separate religion from civil law, and so we actually have a different dynamic in modern culture anyway.
So who separates that? Who makes the decision? What law's here? What's this? What's for this person? How is that decided?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, in Acts 15, it was decided by the Council of Elders. And it's really...
Why don't we keep all the Old Testament? People might ask. Yeah, but why don't we stone an adulteress?
Yeah, but a lot of the civil laws is affected by these laws. For example, if you dig a hole, you know, you see these guys out here working in the manhole, they put a fence around it because when somebody falls in,
exactly,
it's their fault.
Well, again, I will take the principle. If you were to read the ancient Near Eastern laws and read the biblical laws, there's a similar context there. There are understood. In fact, most people think that the compilation of laws we have, they're amendments to a cultural understood spoken law. They're not all inclusive of every single situation. They're not categorized in everything you need to know about property transfer, everything you need to know about this or that. They're kind of here and there, and like these little, in this situation, what do you do? And so they're kind of like examples of justice and maybe some strange circumstances or particular circumstances that you want to highlight and for the greater reason of seeing the principle behind them.
But what's the you know, what I wonder is these laws, how much were they influenced by, like, say, for example, the Code of Hammurabi, right?
Yeah.
You know, were these things, like, divinely inspired? All of them, you know, I saw a book about it the other day. I was talking to a guy. He said, no, you get way off track. You can read that. But how was it influenced by other laws, you know?
Well, in the same way you and I are influenced by our culture that we live in, our worldview we're born into, there are certain assumptions you make that you don't even know they're assumptions. For instance, and some are based on knowledge. I know that a bacteria can make you sick, right? And so I wash my hands to get rid of those bacteria. There are cultures that didn't know that or that do not know that.
Today.
And therefore, they don't practice washing hands. And to them, I might look like a weirdo, but I'm operating off of my knowledge of the world as it is. And in the biblical world, there were certain assumptions. Take slavery, for example. Everybody assumed slavery was just a part of the way the world worked. You need slaves to get anything done, right? Now the question is, how are we going to treat those slaves? Now, in today's world, we don't make that assumption. We actually take some of the principles we've seen in the laws, this value of human life for the sake of human life, and we extrapolate them. And we say, hey, you know what? We don't need slavery. In fact, it's a wrong thing. It's making one person of less value than another. It's giving too much control to other people. And so so I hope nobody here practices slavery. Does anyone here promote slavery?
My wife listens to me once in a while.
Okay.
Doesn't it say that the debtor is like a slave to the person that he owes? Isn't
there might be correlations, yeah. But some of the rules about slavery just simply wouldn't apply because...
Well, I think what you see here in...
Black slavery in America, different question.
Well, don't go back down there. Let's look at today and the incredible amount of kids and women who are being sold into slavery and the whole slave trade. And it's massive. And it's massive across... actually the whole world. I mean, it's not specific to some terrible place.
Yeah, and this,
you know,
would have a thing
America,
to say for that.
Yeah.
Because it says, you know, if you treat the people who are basically have nobody to defend them, I'm going to hear that.
Yeah.
And I will give you your just desserts, basically. That's all. If you must not afflict any widow or orphan. So back to your question. Yeah, there are laws that Christians don't keep. They tend to be the ceremonial laws. But we're still informed by all these laws how to reapply them in our context. And we serve the same God. So the character has to be the same then as it is now.
So does that mean if you're a Christian, you can afflict the widows and the orphans?
No, exactly not. Yeah. because it's the same God. And if he says in verse 24, my anger will burn, he means that. Comment.
Some of the extrapolations are easy, so it's nice to give an example of that, and then we can balance that with a hard question, an easy question. I mentioned the roof, the wall around your roof. The owner of the house and the roof is responsible to protect people from hurting themselves. So in the 21st century, if you have a swimming pool, you need to have a fence around it so that a little grandkid visiting doesn't fall in. That's the easy extrapolation. Everybody can see that and go, oh yeah, that's good. The hard one was one of the hard ones was mentioned earlier. There are two or three areas in the law that we do not follow by principle today. We're against them. For instance, stoning an adulteress or an adulterer. That is not done today. It is illegal in most Western countries, certainly. And
All Western countries.
Yes.
Yeah, you said Western.
Oh, that's true. I did say Western, but I was already thinking of the Middle East.
Right.
And they're not Western. They're Middle Western. Anyway, there's a law that is on the books, and it has been interpreted over the centuries more and more stringently to the point where it really doesn't exist today. In rabbinic Judaism, you don't stone an adulteress, and also Jesus doesn't stone an adulteress. Even though that is not part of the canon, it probably is part of the history, and so it's a good example to discuss when the woman was brought before Jesus. There is an example of a difficult question. How do we justify not following that law? And another law similar to it, when they are in the land, if someone bows down to Baal, they have also committed a capital offense. And that's a law that today we can say, well, that was specific to Israel, and there is no Commonwealth of Israel anymore, so the law doesn't apply, and that gets us off the hook. But it did apply. It was part of the law, and in principle, in most countries today, we have a separation of religious institution and the state, and we no longer allow or put into law our modern states, because they're not theocratic. They don't allow one religion to be called the right one, and then somebody that disobeys that has a capital offense. But that's in, now, it's in Deuteronomy again. I don't think that's in Exodus.
Well, it has, we read about the foreigner living with you can keep the Passover if he's circumcised. So there is an inclusion of the outsiders who are living with you.
But we don't have a law that says if he bows down to Baal, he could be brought before the court and sentenced to death.
Islam doesn't bother with the court. If you in any way berate Allah or Muhammad, you get killed.
Here it just says you must not blaspheme God or curse a ruler of your people. But again, it's leaving it up to you to enforce that law on yourself. It's not enforced by the state, the police, anything like that. That was in verse 28 of Exodus 22.
Isn't it part of, just to say that I'll make a new covenant. No man will tell another. Love the Lord.
Jeremiah, sorry.
We've all sinned and fallen short. So the basic point of when Jesus told the woman who committed adultery, I don't condemn you,
go and sin no more. It was a case of, you have sinned. No question.
Yeah.
Under the law, you've got a death sentence on you. Go and sin no more. And the new covenant is that the Lord now speaks rather than men applying the law to other people. It is a case of, if we have been forgiven by Jesus, and we effectively have to police ourselves. We don't go around policing other people, stoning them for their transgressions. We have to make sure that we don't transgress ourselves.
Yeah, for sure. We have to make sure. I mean, there's bigger issues here than we could ever cover in 1 hour. But did you have a short comment to say?
Yeah. I love it when God says, you behave this way because I am compassionate.
Right.
That's right in verse 27. And so he wants us to be compassionate one to another.
Right.
And when you read these laws, then you see you are treating other people really well.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, give them rest so that they can be refreshed. We have this caring God who's full of compassion. And when we live that way, what do we want to do? We want to bring our first fruits to him and be really thankful.
Right.
That's what I see when I read this.
Yeah, no, the overall principles stand out. And as I mentioned earlier, the way slaves, the laws pertaining to slaves in the Bible are on a much higher level because slaves are humans made in the image of God. And that fact is highlighted in the Bible, where in the ancient Near East, the laws basically treat them like property. And so there are distinctions that set biblical law apart, and those distinctions need to stay eternal.
And definitely, while I am not an expert on any of this, one thing I remember thinking through at one point, man, this is so harsh, God. And I just had to think through some of these issues. And then, like she said, where God is pointing out how he is compassionate, and then there's other verses of the Lord, merciful and kind,
yeah.
How his mercy and compassion really overrides everything. And then there are some of these laws that would seem strict to us. But then again, while I'm not the expert, I've had other people talk to me about it and say, Michael, if you were to actually follow those laws, even those laws are extremely hard to follow. So first off, you need two or three witnesses. How many two or three people are walking in on a couple, having an affair? They have to be the first ones to stone them. It's not like just an angry crowd can do it. I mean,
right.
There are so many checks and balances along the way that
right.
The ultimate punishment is extreme. But there are so many things that need to happen before you can even get to that.
It would be almost impossible.
Yeah, so it's not like God is like, kill everyone, you know?
Yeah,
it's just
right.
Like, yes, it's extreme, but it's hard to even get to that point in a way. And I wish I could cite the quotation, but supposedly I've heard it said that somewhere in the Talmud, and not that the Talmud, everything it says is accurate, but it quotes this idea of if a Sanhedrin had killed, you know, up to two people in 7 years or something, then it was a murderous council. You know, this idea of,
yeah.
It's not like they were looking to be killing as many people as they could.
Sure. No, you're looking to preserve life.
Yeah.
And always.
You know, last week it says that those who hate God, they will be cursed up to the third and fourth generation. But it says those who love God, their generations will be blessed for thousands of generations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like one five hundredth, the curse is, right?
Right.
One blessing.
So, yeah, so thankfully the blessings far outweigh.
Can I ask you a historical question?
Okay.
So were these laws ever really put in? I mean, did they ever follow them?
They tried to. The Pharisees definitely tried to.
Well, the Pharisees are jumping 2,000 years forward.
Yeah.
And if you think we did that in our world and jumped 2,000 years, that's a totally different context. You're right, they did follow them. But the people who originally got these laws would have tried to follow them as well, and probably wouldn't have followed them in the exact same way that Pharisees did. The answer to that is a very complex one. For sure, at some point, they're following the law. Whether they kill, I don't know. I don't think so.
They tried to kill the adulterers with Jesus.
I think,
well, that was a trick question. I mean, I don't know if they're really going to do it.
I think what Michael said holds, that a lot of these laws show an ideal of justice, and in practicality, they weren't necessarily followed on a literal basis. For instance, back to Sarna's book on exploring Exodus that I recommended, he argues that the eye for eye, tooth for tooth, that was a formula that expressed that there should be, the punishment should fit the crime equally.
The value.
The value. And that when it's used in the Bible, if you look at it in the context, it doesn't, it's not even used in instances where you're talking about eyes and stuff. And so it's actually, it's a phrase that is already known. We have it also in Hammurabi's code and elsewhere. And so the Bible is using it not as literally go pluck their eye out, but you know this concept already, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. It means exact justice. And so I'm saying the law I just gave you, I'm giving the rationale of this needs to be exact justice here. And so it's not necessarily that by quoting eye for eye, tooth for tooth, you're saying go ahead and go gouge out the eye. You're saying this principle you see in eye for eye, tooth for tooth needs to be applied here.
Even by the time of Jesus' day, there it becomes money. So
yeah.
The eye had a certain value of money.
Exactly. And actually, Sarna would argue that it always implied money, except in Hammurabi's code. Originally, it was money, and then Hammurabi changed it to say that it could actually have a physical effect on the people. But then that physical gouging would be compared to a certain amount of money, and so you could pay instead of doing that. So it's complex, but I would recommend going to read the book because it does shed light on the cultural context the laws are given in, and that definitely influences how you read them and how you understand them. And you could drastically misunderstand a law if you don't read it in the context. And that's, I think, what, if you take Micah's words, walk humbly with your God, that's the most important thing. Don't then try to take some law like, oh, we haven't gotten this right if we're not pulling out a stone and stoning this person. Be very careful, because you might not understand the law you're reading.
Can the Ten Commandments bring a basis to this, that they are the commandments and then other things are on top of that? Or does that help at all? That we're New Testaments to keep the Ten Commandments yet and Jesus and then all the other laws after that, you know?
Maybe.
I'm looking at verse 8 and verse 7. The one about the 6 years, sow the fields, and then by keeping the Sabbath.
Right.
Now, the Sabbath is in the Ten Commandments.
It is.
The 6 years of your fields is not in the Ten Commandments.
No. Jesus answered that question when they said, what's the greatest law? If you follow that, you follow everything.
Yeah.
So you should love the Lord your God.
Yeah, yeah.
And love
right.
your neighbor as yourself. If you manage to achieve those in all its ramifications, then you've got the whole world.
Do you, as a New Testament Christian, keep the Ten Commandments?
Sorry?
Do you keep the Ten Commandments?
We don't get through that, it is the case that we try and keep
contact. I say almost all we look at maybe keeping the Sabbath. I think we keep nine of them, and the Sabbath, I don't know.
Where's Nadim?
Well, I've turned on my mobile phone today. I've broken the...
yeah.
Well, but again, that's interpretation,
yes.
Right? Just as one of the laws we read was don't boil a little goat in its mother's milk. Well, that verse comes in our passage. It comes in two other passages in the Bible. And so the question is...
And it's
is,
the basic foundation for the Shrut.
How do you understand it?
Yeah.
And we go back to this verse a lot in our house because you have to understand where Kashrut comes from today.
Right.
What is eating kosher? Why do they do what they do? Why do they not eat meat and milk? And it goes back to this verse. And if you understand it differently, it would lead to a whole different way of interpretation. For instance, today in our modern world, I think there's very little fear of mixing the exact little goat with its own mother's milk. For one, most people don't drink goat milk. They drink cow's milk.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to eat the bird and the egg too, so if you eat it...
Okay, so now you're going
eat,
to the principle behind
eat,
it.
If you eat an egg and you eat chicken at the same time, maybe you're eating egg from that chicken.
Okay, but if you're trying to understand this law, it's not talking about chickens, it's talking about baby goats. You know, if you're
trying
to preserve that exact law, you wouldn't be at risk of breaking it very easily in a modern world. But in an ancient world, where you have a certain amount of goats and cows in your own field, and everyone's drinking goat milk primarily, and you just had a baby goat that you're going to cook... If you're going to boil it in milk, the chances are it's going to come from milk from its own mom. And so...
Didn't Avram serve as guest?
I always understood that it actually was a pagan practice at some point.
Well, that's the other explanation that I'm given to, that there was actually... but I don't even know if it was pagan or just that pagans had this meal that God was against because maybe it violated this principle.
It's like
But the fact that it comes three times means it was significant. Everyone was practicing it around them or it had some special significance that we really need to stay away from.
I told some Orthodox friends at supper last night, it's Chinese New Year and we have a big Chinese New Year party tomorrow night and I have said there's to be no meat. And one of the guys said, why? I said, because we're sort of verging towards trying to keep kosher because I don't mix meat enough now. But it was just funny because you can't, technically in a Jewish sense, you can't try to keep kosher. You either separate completely,
right,
and it goes to ludicrous extremes, like you have to have another dishwasher
yes,
and
right,
another this.
Right.
Yeah, I have different plates and knives and forks, and that's about my limit. But anyway.
And sinks.
I have two sinks too.
Yeah.
But they don't always get pristinely kept.
Right, right. Yeah, so there becomes this whole elaborate guard to keeping that one law. Precisely because it comes three times, they couldn't figure out exactly why it was so important. But it clearly was, and so let's just guard it from every single angle we could possibly imagine, and that way there's no way we're going to break that little P in the middle of all our mattresses.
You know it's big business. That's true. It's
yeah.
big business.
It's very big business. And I will say that I only do it so that Orthodox Jews will come into my house. There was one famous occasion when a very, very Orthodox couple came and I offered them a cup of tea, which seemed to me pretty innocuous.
In Chai Pani?
What?
Did you...
No, I don't think I did. Glass cups or whatever. It doesn't matter. I said, do you want a cup of tea? And he said, is the kettle kosher? So I said, Siggy, I forgot to tell you that I boil my pork sausages in my kettle every morning. And his wife said, you deserve that. And whether they had the cup of tea or not, I don't remember. Anyway.
Well.
And they have the pork sausage.
I detect some hyperbole in saying, let's go ahead and read Isaiah 48. But doing so, we'll have to... Yeah, we have very little time. So maybe two people can read us through this. Do you have English?
Yes.
Why don't you look,
I have refined you, but not as silver. I have purified you in the furnace of misery. For my sake alone I will act. For how can I allow my name to be defiled? I will not share my glory with anyone else. Listen to me, O Jacob, Israel, whom I summoned. I am the one. I am present at the very beginning and at the very end. Yes, my hand founded the earth. My right hand spread out the sky. I summon them. They stand together. All of you, gather together and listen. Who among them announced these things? The Lord's ally will carry out his desire against Babylon. He will exert his power against the Babylonians. I have spoken. Yes, I have summoned him. I lead him, and he will succeed. Approach me. Listen to this. From the very first, I have not spoken in secret. When it happens, I am there. So now the Sovereign Lord has sent me, accompanied by His Spirit. This is what the Lord, your Protector, says, the Holy One of Israel. I am the Lord your God, who teaches you how to succeed, who leads you in the way you should go. If only you had obeyed my commandments, prosperity would have flowed to you like a river. Deliverance would have come to you like the waves of the sea. Your descendants would have been as numerous as sand, and your children like its granules. Their name would not have been cut off and eliminated from my presence. Leave Babylon, flee from the Babylonians. Announce it with a shout of joy. Make this known. Proclaim it throughout the earth. Say, the Lord protects his servant, Jacob. And then the last verse, from chapter 49, verse 3. He said to me, you are my servant, Israel, through whom I will reveal my splendor.
So, What do you see as a link between these two passages?
I got struck by verse 18. If only you'd paid attention to my commands, your peace would have been like a river, your well-being like the waves of the sea. So for me, all the stuff we've just been reading in Exodus...
Said peace and well-being?
I've got your well-being...
Oh.
Your peace would have been like a river, is what I have. What have you got?
In Hebrew, it's shalom, isn't it?
Yeah.
Shalom is the first one, yes.
If only you paid attention to my commands...
If only you listened to my commands... Your shalom, so your peace, your well-being would be like a river, and your tzedakah would be like the waves of the sea.
Oh, so the well-being is tzedakah.
Yes, which could either be translated righteousness, but it can also have a sense of justice. So in that sense, maybe my translation also has deliverance. Like when you're justified, when you're vindicated.
Right.
That sense of your righteousness or justice. But it's interesting. Does anyone's translation have righteousness there?
Yeah.
Yes.
But peace and righteousness.
Yeah, the river of your righteousness. It is said.
Yeah.
So this is basically saying you didn't do it, couldn't do it, so I'm sending you Redeemer, which was the plan all along. And Paul says that's the point. Right.
That's not how I read it. What I read it was that if you paid attention to these commands, you stuck a roof round your parapet, round your roof or whatever, or you did rescue this wandering off ox or whatever, the result would be is that you would have peace. You would have a flowing peace. You would be in tune with who I am. Jesus says, if you believe in me, out of your belly will flow rivers of living water. Out of us will come a sort of sense of peace and well-being.
And especially, because, you know, if you helped your neighbor's ox, it's harder for you to hate the person you're helping.
That's right.
It's like Christians do. You pray for somebody you don't like, right? It's harder to not like them if you're constantly praying for them.
That's right.
And so the net result is that both you and your enemy are going to be reconciled, because they're going to notice the good thing you're doing for them, and so are you. It's going to have an impact on your feelings.
Yeah, but if people are not falling off your roof, you're not going to be getting dragged to court all the time either, you know? So you're not
sure,
going to have that problem.
Sure. And if you're improving city conditions for foreigners who live in your land, they're not going to hate you as much. If you set up good, clean water for people, it's going to help them.
You know, it's like, well, I remember on Yom Kippur one time I went to King of Kings, and the guy that was speaking, he said, you don't have to keep Yom Kippur, but if you do, you will be blessed.
Hmm.
You know?
The social justice is basically it's secondary. Primary, from this passage, is we need a redeemer, a servant. And Isaiah is saying, you didn't do it. I'm providing a savior. And Paul says that's the point of these laws, to show us what we didn't do, to show us we need a savior. And I'm not denying that social justice isn't significant. What I'm saying is I think it's secondary to the primary message.
If the only primary message is to show us that we need a savior, it seems a little bit lopsided. First, you wouldn't have to go through all of them. You could just point out a few basics, and you already have it.
Well, how do you understand Paul then?
Well, if these laws were given only to prove that you couldn't follow them, wouldn't that be a strange character for God to be?
Isn't that what Paul said?
What does he mean?
Yeah, but it doesn't.
Not exactly.
It doesn't say it in Exodus. It talks about him being compassionate and loving and caring and whatever.
Paul says the law is a tutor.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a schoolmaster.
That it was that the only purpose was being a tutor, because Paul himself continued to keep them. He didn't just throw them out.
We have one more question over here.
What does it mean by when the Lord says, I have tried you in the furnace of affliction?
Well, I think that's actually our biggest connector. The first verse mentions both money, as did the beginning of our Exodus. If you lend money, it specifically says kesef, silver, to the poor among you. And the fire of affliction is this word oni. can also be poverty. I think it means the affliction you land in when you are exiled. When you are people ripped from your land, you become in the slave category, right? You no longer have anyone to defend you. You now have become exactly the category we've been talking about in Exodus, of this person who could be abused in society because no one really cares about you. You're not them. You're different. And you're set up for abuse. And I'm sure it happened in any of the exiles. And so it's interesting. Our Hebrew text actually says, I chose you in the furnace of affliction. But our Isaiah scroll from Qumran says, I've tested you. So tested in the sense of purifying, if you're going to follow the metaphor. Bechartiha, instead of Bechanticha. Pasuk Eser. It's verse 10. The second half of verse 10, I'm talking about, in my translation says, I have purified you in the furnace of misery. Qumran scroll, Isaiah A, has Bechanticha, I have tested you, which matches better the first half of refining. So it's an interesting way of looking at affliction.
That what?
That they're being refined through it.
Right. I mean, that's very that's very much
Deuteronomistic.
Well, no, it's
and Christian.
No, it's Paul.
It's Paul. It's a lot. Yeah. Just be careful on that one. Don't start. Let God say that, not people. Because if you go around saying, "Well, you have cancer because God's testing you," I'm not sure that you can be justified.
You know, blessing.
Would this be more like a way of humbling people? Like the Lord is humbling people?
For sure it's humbling. I mean, again, the root oni, affliction, is the same as poverty, and humility is a related... It's actually, yeah, related root. They're all humble people. Poor people are humble because they're the bottom of society. You had another comment?
Yeah, just the thought. If the overall hope and goal is to sort of reflect the nature of God in heaven, I think it's interesting how... Right above, and also we read, he says, he's saying then, you have never heard, you have never known. From of old your ear has not been opened, for I knew that you would surely deal treacherously, and that from before birth you were called a rebel. For my name's sake I defer my anger, for the sake of my praise I restrain it for you, that I may not cut you off. Behold, I have refined you, but not as silver. I have tried you in the furnace affliction. For my own sake I do it. For how should my name be profaned? My glory I will not give to another. Anyway, all this is to say, even God withholds back a lot, even though he could do this and this and this, because I even knew from the beginning you would not be obedient, you would deal treacherously, but even he is showing this reserve or this compassion, and again, it goes back to that law. Even though I can stone you right now, I am choosing not to for the sake of my love and my compassion. Yeah.
Because in the end, his covenants are based on his character, which is unchanging.
Yeah.
Even though we mess up all the time, people of Israel messed up, we mess up. It's the same principle, that it's based on God's mercy and God's ability to withhold his own wrath on us.
Even though he has it right, he still chooses to withhold
that's
it.
Right.
Well, he has a plan for us, too. That's in verse 3, it says, you are my servant, Israel, in whom I will be glorified.
Right. Well, it's very interesting, those that bear my name, you know, Israel bared God's name, and we as Christians were grafted in. You know, Christian means little Christ. We also then bear his name, all Christians. And it's a very interesting thing for me to think about over history, because there's so much the church has done that is shameful and that is embarrassing. And, you know, the things they've done, I read about them, and I think, oh, Lord, how could you stand that? And yet, there's grace because we bear his name. And he has to be faithful to himself. And so he's got to balance all of that. And there's so many situations that his grace applies to. It kind of boggles our mind.
You know, it's interesting what Jim read from Isaiah 48:18. if only you had obeyed my commandments, prosperity would have flowed to you, or peace would have flowed to you like a river. Deliverance would have come to you like the waves of the sea. And then it kind of goes into your descendants would have been like the sand. And so you think about like...
The promise to Abraham.
The promise to Abraham. But then you're thinking of like a seashore next to this Yam, that there's sand, right, when you go on the beach. But then it reminds me of Amos, right? 5.
Let justice roll on like a mighty...
Exactly. Let justice flow like a mighty river or torrents of water. And let your righteousness like a stream that never dries up.
Yeah.
And if you look at this context here in Amos 5:23, you know, God's saying, take away from me your noisy songs. I don't want to hear the music of your stringed instruments.
Where are you now?
Amos 5.
Amos 5, sorry.
And then in verse 25 of Amos 5, you do not bring me sacrifices and grain offerings during the 40 years you spent in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look back at Isaiah, it's saying, you know, or not in Isaiah, in Exodus 22, it talks about bringing the offerings to God. And also in Isaiah 48, remember he says, leave Babylon, flee from the Babylonians, announce it with a shout of joy, a rina, a kol rina.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this kind of idea of this singing where they're leaving Babylon as well. So kind of interesting with Amos 5.
Some poetic links to Amos 5.
I was going to
say, if only you were back in those days, you could have put your little haftarah in there.
That's right.
Amos 5 could be tacked on when we've been looking at that this morning.
I was just going to say that so often Christians read the law and then they make a jump to how Judaism of today works out that law and says, well, it doesn't belong to us, it's nothing to do with us. And I think what you have to do is when you see something, you have to understand it in the both in the context that it was said, but also in the context of today. You know, very clearly, let's go back to the kashrut laws a minute, not mixing milk and meat. You have to decide why you're doing it. I do it simply for to respect Orthodox who might come. But the same thing goes with Shabbat. I'm not going to keep Shabbat. I'm not going to come under law. What does it mean? It's very clear you're to honor Shabbat. And for every individual, you're going to keep your Shabbat in the way you want to keep Shabbat, the way the Lord shows you how to keep Shabbat. Mm-hmm. The same thing with honoring your parents or whatever.
Shabbat is the one law that goes back to creation in some accounts.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Exodus, and it's designed for foreigners who aren't necessarily Israelites.
That's right. But the whole point is that people get stuck on, oh, it means you can't turn the light on, or you can't drive a car,
right,
or you can't do this, you can't. And that's not what it was meaning at all.
Sure.
Yeah, but don't you think it's nice not to have buses on Shabbat, cars on Shabbat?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Okay.
It's nice.
If we're going to talk about Shabbat, that merits several more Bible studies. There's no way we can do it justice. But I do appreciate the peaceful Shabbat today.
Can I say a general thing about the law?
Okay. A general thing about the law really quick?
Just that I know for myself, it's obviously much preferred to have everything be cut and dry. And I have often tried to think of the law in that way, the Torah, God's instructions. And a friend of mine once told me it's just like a diamond. And I think that was the most helpful explanation I ever heard, because the diamond has all these different faces, and if you turn it one way, in that moment it's convicting you, it's showing you how much of a failure you are, and you need a savior. And if you turn it this way, it's actually life, and it's instruction. And if you turn it this way, it's not just one cut or dry, it's this or it's that. It has these multiple facets, where on one hand it leads you to repentance, and on the other hand it
shows you how to live.
So take your diamond and keep twisting it and looking at it. And Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you very much. It's good to
start. So it's good.
Shut down.
I feel like it was like right out of the gate.